From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Spalding Gray talks with us about his new monologue, in which he confesses that he had an affair that broke up his marriage and made him a father. It's his 15th monologue. He says it's his most personal, but it has provoked boos and hisses from some audience members. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Counting Crows' new CD, Recovering the Satellites. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. NASA has decided to bring the space shuttle Columbia home tomorrow after all. Flight directors made up their minds today because bad weather is predicted for Cape Canaveral on Friday. Earlier this week, the space agency had decided to move the landing from Thursday to Friday to give an ultraviolet telescope more observation time. But NASA changed its mind after learning of the bad weather forecast. The Columbia crew has already retrieved the telescope from orbit and returned it to the shuttle bay. The Supreme Court hears arguments today in the controversy over mandating English only in government offices. The justices will review a lower court decision invalidating an Arizona provision that requires state workers to speak and use English only while on the job. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1988, Arizona voters narrowly approved an amendment to the state constitution barring state employees from using any language other than English in carrying out their official duties. The law was soon challenged by a state employee who handled medical malpractice claims against the state. The employee, fluent in both English and Spanish, spoke English to people who wanted to speak English and Spanish to those more comfortable in Spanish. When the English-only law went into effect, she stopped speaking Spanish and went to court, claiming that the law violated her right of free speech. The lower court struck down the English-only law as unconstitutional. Today, the justices will hear the case argued, but they may not consider just the merits of the case, rather whether either party in the case has suffered a direct enough harm to legally justify a lawsuit. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Foreign ministers from more than 50 countries are meeting in London to discuss progress on the Dayton Peace Accords for Bosnia. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The delegates to the conference have been reviewing the progress, or lack of it, in implementing the Dayton Peace Agreement. The foreign ministers were welcomed by British Prime Minister John Major and then listened to a hard assessment of what still needed to be done presented by the High Representative of the International Community in Bosnia, Carl Bildt. It's Bildt's job to oversee the implementation of the civilian aspects of the Dayton Accord, such as human rights, the right of refugees to return to their homes, the creation of a stable government and written constitution, and finally, cooperation with the International War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. In all of these areas, Bildt pointed out, the three warring factions had failed to live up to the letter of the Dayton Agreement. Bildt said the parties must live up to their commitments. Time is running out, he told the foreign ministers, adding, so is the patience of the international community. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The Federal Reserve has released its Beige Book, or its periodic survey of the economy. It finds that economic growth continues to expand at a moderate pace and consumer spending has increased. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 16 points at 64.27. This is NPR. A Hawaii judge's ruling that the state must issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples doesn't mean the legal battle is over. The state will go on turning away gay and lesbian couples until its appeal is heard. Meanwhile, state officials are seeking a stay of the judge's order. The decision says that Hawaii's ban on gay and lesbian marriages violates the state's constitution. Advocates of same-sex marriages have applauded this decision, but the American Center for Law and Justice, which supports the ban, calls the decision an outrage. Burma's military government has confined opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi to her home while student demonstrators attempt to stage another rally. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
The human rights group Amnesty International says Aung San Suu Kyi's compound is now sealed and no one can enter it or leave it. Amnesty says some of Suu Kyi's last visitors, five members of her party's youth organization, were detained after they left yesterday. The junta claims that Suu Kyi is still free to leave her house at will, but aides of Suu Kyi's have told reporters that she was stopped today when she tried to leave. Suu Kyi has already spent 6 years under house arrest, ending in July 95. During that time, she won the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize. It's not clear whether Suu Kyi is now back under house arrest or whether the junta only wants to keep her off the streets temporarily. After the student protests earlier this week, the junta may fear that Suu Kyi's charismatic presence would only add fuel to a smoldering fire. I'm Mary Kay Magstad reporting.
A Paris newspaper says Algerian Islamic militants are leading suspects in yesterday's deadly subway bombing. The Daily Le Monde quotes an unidentified official, as saying there's been warnings for months that an attack might be coming. No one has claimed responsibility for yesterday's blast that killed two people and seriously hurt 35 others. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Spalding Gray created a performance style that has become a genre, the onstage autobiographical monologue. Everyone who has followed his monologues over the years knows that he's incredibly self-conscious and neurotic. He's a hypochondriac who's always sure he's developing a fatal illness. And although he'd like to live more in the moment, he's always standing back and analyzing it. Well, in his new monologue, It's a Slippery Slope, which is currently performing at Lincoln Center in New York, Gray tells us about a couple of huge changes in his life. First, he's made some progress in getting out of his head. He's learned to ski. Second, there's something that he neglected to tell us in his last monologue, which ended with his wedding to his longtime companion and collaborator, Renee Shafransky. When they married, he was having an affair. That affair has since ended the marriage and produced a child, Grace First. More on that a little later. Let's start with skiing. I asked Spalding Gray why skiing has taken on so much meaning for him.
I think learning to ski took on a lot of meaning for me for lots of different reasons. But the first one that comes to mind is that I had not realized that anxiety is a fear without an object, and that I'd been anxious all my life and had no real specific fear, because we're living, me with everyone else, in such a virtual age that all the caveman stuff, leave that out the window, but I mean, there was no specific fear that I could locate in my life. So I was feeling all this anxiety. And when I saw people coming down that mountain, I realized that this was a fearful thing to me. Now, I had watched people ride the elements for years. And riding the elements, as we all know, has become more and more popular, due, I think, to the virtual reality thing. But when I was a kid, people weren't jumping out of airplanes, bungee jumping, surfing, windsurfing. Now that they are, I began looking at it, and I would make a joke saying, if I was ever reincarnated, I'd like to come back as a blues-singing surfer. You know, I'd like to sing the blues, and I'd love to surf. And then as I got to be about 52, I thought, well, this is, I probably won't be reincarnated. And if I'm going to do Ride One of the Elements, I better choose it. And the choice was already made because it had been in my in my history. I hadn't chosen it when I could have taken free lessons. And so this was such a big thing to me, to confront a direct fear of heights, the size of the mountain, falling, all of that, and to have survived it was just great.
So you think that since you had all this free-floating anxiety, to focus your anxiety on overcoming something you were actually really fearful of would be a good discipline?
I would say in hindsight, yeah. When I was doing it, or when I was starting to it felt right. In fact, I was learning it. That's the sense that I got. The sense was that I'd never really learned anything. I mean, I walk, and that's about it. And I can still ride a bike. And that's mechanical. So this skiing thing required that you be able to do it like other people, and I didn't have any faith in that. So it also developed that I became someone else. Yeah, well, I'm a skier now, and that's I'm also a father. Those are two things that are parallel, if you will, that I never expected. So when I say it's not, the fat lady hasn't sung yet.
You have a funny line about having fun in the day.
Yeah.
Is that very unusual for you to be having fun in the daytime?
When I scream out, my people having fun in the day, I never know those. Lots of those lines are funny. They're just throwing out, and you know, as you know, I don't know how much of the audience knows, but these monologues aren't pre-written. And I sit down for the first time and tell the story as I remember it from an outline. So I'm babbling away and all sorts of lines are coming out of me, and then all of a sudden they'll get a laugh and the audience will teach me that it's funny for them, and then I'll play it. So they're really my editors as well. But that's a favorite line of mine now, and I had to think of why is that funny, because they laughed, you know what I mean? So now I know why it's funny, but they made me think about it.
So why is it
having
funny?
Fun in the day, because I think it's funny because we equate in our Puritan decadent consciousness that you know, fun can only be had at night, you know. Fun in the day is California versus you know, Puritan East Coast.
Well, also people who tend to have more decadent forms of fun tend to have that fun in the night.
And, exactly, and also people are working in the day, and who has fun working? You know, I'm happy to say that I still do. I worry that most people don't, particularly airline mechanics.
When you decided, skiing, that could be a good monologue, when you realized you'd be writing a monologue or doing a monologue about skiing, did it alter the experience of skiing?
Yeah, it did. You know, I think it has a little bit. Because I thought skiing was going to be my first big private act, you know.
Your very first.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't discuss my sex life in detail. And skiing is not unlike sex. They say, you know, it's the most fun you can have with your clothes on. And why it's similar to sex to me is that, for me anyway, one thinks that sex can never, you know, one thinks it must get boring. It can't be continued and regenerated, and you can get into a place where you say, oh, what was that? And then all of a sudden, it's there again. And that, for me, is the skiing, is continually there as an enthusiastic drive. But where am I? What is the question?
I don't know, but let me ask you this. The one time I ever tried skiing when I was a freshman in college in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, that would be the mistake.
Everybody said, oh, it's the big social thing to do, so you must do it. So I thought, well, they know what they're talking about, so I must do it. And I immediately fell, and I chipped a tooth, and I thought, this is not fun. I am not interested. I will never, ever do this again. What prevented you, who are not particularly athletic, from going through that same experience and having that same conclusion?
Yeah, I was lucky that that didn't happen to me, because in Freiburg, Maine, when I was going to school there in 1956, and that's where the monologue opens, at Freiburg Academy, the ski lessons were offered to me for free, and I was the apotheosis of a couch potato. I mean, I say I went back and listened to Beethoven's 9 symphonies. I did, in my dorm room. And I would go into a kind of, like, fantasy dreamscape because it was too cold out. I wasn't in my body in any sense. I was not athletic. And all of this came very late. Now, had I gotten out there and gotten on that New England ice and not been initiated through the West, I think probably I never would have returned to it. So I think that the whole rhythm of it is beautiful. And recently I was playing in Bowdoin, the monologue in Bowdoin College in New Brunswick, Maine, and I had to go to Vermont to perform and to Burlington, and I drove across and I went the route through Freiburg, Maine, and I stopped and saw that first mountain outside Freiburg Academy, that first little hill that I saw, relived this whole route, and then when I got to this mountain, Wildcat, which is right near Mount Washington, I jumped out. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I had my skis in the car and I was in my ski outfit, and I just jumped right into the line, didn't buy a ticket, no one questioned me, and it was like a dream. I did that afternoon. I skied what everyone was skiing in 1956. It was a beautiful afternoon. Mount Washington was huge, gleaming white behind me. The wind wasn't heavy. The conditions were perfect, and I thought, yeah, just had to wait a little while.
So are you still skiing?
I can't wait. I'm booked. I mean, I'm looking for the first time in my life, I look forward to the winters. And I wiped out at the end of this season, not in the monologue. I was in Tahoe skiing at the end of the season. It was April 7th, and I just skied a double black diamond 3 times, and so was feeling on top of things, and it said for super experts only, and I was going in for lunch, and my guard was down. I hit a patch of ice, was airborne, and hit a tree. Broke 3 ribs. Was lucky I wasn't impaled because it was one of these low stumps that was just waiting for me. And so that was the end of that season. And I want to go back because had I not run that double black diamond, I probably would have thrown it in too and said, I'm very lucky to be alive. But I've already booked my monologue at Salt Lake City and Park City and in Aspen. So I'll be playing in Aspen in February and then going to Park City with my son, who's 4, who will be skiing with me there and going to ski school in the day, and then we'll ski in the afternoon.
So have you skied yet since you...
I haven't skied since I wiped out. Well, you know what happened was that I went down to ski patrol and said, I can't, you know, I was pale, I can't breathe. And they said, you've probably broken a few ribs, we'll take you down the stretcher. I said, no, I want to ski down. So they made me sign out. I had to sign a release form saying that they were not responsible. And he said, the last question in the form was, how do you think this accident could have been prevented? Which was just a great absurd question. I said, probably not by not ever having skied was the answer. And then I skied down this double black diamond, and with these 3 broken ribs, I skied another hour, which was crazy. It was not a wise thing to do.
Spalding, this is not behavior befitting a hypochondriac.
Exactly. Well, it's the other side of it. It's, you know, it's the self... No, it wasn't self-destructive. I was lucky that the 3 ribs were lower and they weren't poking into my lungs. But when I got down the mountain, the San Francisco Bee was waiting there to do an article on me, and we ended up going to the hospital and they did photographs of me getting the MRI, you know, so it all... But now, when you say it's not behavior fitting to a hypochondriac, that takes you back to creating the fear to alleviate the anxiety. You see, the hypochondriac is always looking for the disease. Of course, hypochondriasis is a way of protecting oneself. It's a form of religion, because as long as you can imagine the disease, you have control over it. It's the disease you're not imagining. It's going to kill you. But in hypochondriasis, you see, it was, again, focusing. I never think about illness or accident when I'm skiing. And I should. I should. I'm very aware of accident and going through the woods now on a day that appears to be very warm, but when the trees are there, it creates icy conditions. So I learned all about that in that day.
Spalding Gray is my guest, and he's performing a new monologue called It's a Slippery Slope. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Spalding Gray, and he's performing a new monologue called It's a Slippery Slope. The last part of your monologue continues on a very personal part of your life. In fact, it picks up where your previous monologue ended. Your previous monologue, Grey's Anatomy, ended with your getting married to Renee Shafransky, who was your longtime lover and the director of some of your performances, the editor of some of your work. At the end of your new monologue, you confess that you were having an affair with another woman at the time you were married, and that, in fact, while you were married, she became pregnant with your baby, and you've since left Renee, and you're living with the woman who you had a son with. Her name is Kathy, and you're living together, and, in fact, you're expecting another child in January. This is such a surprising thing to hear.
Yeah, it was a surprising event for me to have happen. If you think that I can fill you in on what I think the underneath of all of that is, I think I'm still processing it. But
right.
what is the specific question?
Well, I'm not sure. I think part of the question is that for the first time, I felt myself, instead of just kind of identifying with you and say, "Boy, that's Spalding. He really understands neurosis."
Right.
I was
right.
thinking, "Boy, that's Spalding. He did something that really upsets me."
Right,
you know,
right.
I'm really upset that he was having an affair while
right.
he married Renee. I don't know Renee, but I feel like I know her through your monologues. Through
right.
having followed your life, I know something about her life, and she feels like a friend, you know, in the way that characters in books that you read feel
yeah.
like friends. I feel like, well, you know, you betrayed my friend, and I don't feel good about that.
Right. So how are you feeling now?
Well,
I mean,
still processing it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that you don't pay a lot of attention to my life because you have your own and you have other people that you interview. But that's been, when I say common, I mean, not an not an un, you know, it's been a common response from women that I've gotten letters and people have spoken to me about it. And I expected that to happen because I felt that too. And this monologue is a watershed monologue in this sense that I would say that what happened to me, and this isn't a disclaimer, and it sounds a little Jungian and romantic, but not a midlife crisis. My press bite on the monologue is, oh, it's about surviving a midlife crisis by finding my balance on skis. I think midlife crisis is another one of those American pop psychology words to make things lighter, as in Peter Pan complex versus the pura eternus, which is a little deeper in the sense of perpetual child, a more Jungian concept. And I'd say what happened to me was I really encountered my shadow in a major way. And it was not just the affair with Kathy in the midst of getting married that set these things, that triggered a lot of this breakdown. And the story of the breakdown, and it's not something I lay on you, it's not in the monologue, but it is a very long and complicated tale about me really collapsing around that period for all sorts of reasons, for overload situations that were probably exacerbated by the affair. But I don't, when I do the monologue, I want to keep the audience laughing. I'm trying to keep that balance mm-hmm. between shadow and light. But there are places that are very complicated that I probably could go into write about. But Renee left me. And for good reason. I mean, she had no choice. But I can remember one of the crisis points was that I was bi-coastal at the time. A lot of this was going on. So I had two therapists. I had one in New York City and one in Los Angeles. And at the time, Renee and I were in Los Angeles, and I have amnesia around a lot of this because I was pretty out there. Why we were there, I don't know. But I remember going into my therapist and not being able to sit in the chair. I was bouncing out of the chair, pacing around the room, rolling on the floor, letting out with yellings, involuntary yelps. And he said he needed Renee to come in the following day. And the following day she came in and said, the reason I brought you in is that you are his wife. You are legally responsible for him. And I would suggest that you get a legal separation because he is about to be put in a straitjacket. We have a law here in California. I want to call it the 510 law, but that's the Berkeley area code. But I'm not great at numbers, but it's one of those codes that if you have the kind of behavior he's manifesting in public, he can be put away. And that's what it looks like is about to happen. And we can't, commit him now. So this is when Renee did a legal separation. It was right after he said that. And she had organized friends of mine to go to California when I'd been in various hold-up situations. In the monologue, I talk about myself going out to California and her calling to say she'd seen Kathy with a baby. But in fact, also, she was going to have three friends go out and have me committed a number of times. And she would not have been off base on that. So a lot of stuff was happening. I mean, I feel very, very fortunate to be back in the saddle. And the woman that I'm seeing now as a therapist is a very strict and imaginative Jungian, and she is saying, stay off the lithium, which I was on, stay off the Klonopin, stay off the anti-Tourette's drugs. I was on three different drugs. You have just wrestled with your shadow and won. You have survived your mother's suicide. You've survived your mother's death. You and Renee were in a fused relationship. There's no way that couldn't have gone down. Now, I accept a lot of what she says. I still haven't been able to find my own voice about that. Now, I'm not a nice guy, and I wasn't a nice guy there. And where this monologue is different from the others is I'm no longer the infantilized child turning the audience into a mom, in particular the women, and saying, hey, look at me, I'm drowning. Renee loves me. She gives me unconditional love, and I always come back to her. But also, look out, I'm going out again. And so all of that behavior that I talk about in this monologue was going on all the time in the others, but you didn't know that. And I'm not a nice guy, Terry.
Well, see, that's the thing. I was picking up on that
friend.
In the monologue. Yeah. Well, you know, here's the other thing. You know, you broke a confidence with your wife because when you married her, you were having a secret affair. But I think that your audience can almost say you broke a confidence with them in the sense that you talked about the marriage in your previous monologue and you didn't let on to us, your audience, that there was this whole other story about this affair going on at the same time.
This is a good point, actually, and I discussed it with Renee. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of things that happened around that. When we were getting married, I was in such a state and feeling so guilty about this. And also...
Guilty about the affair.
Yeah, but also the affair, there was a hiatus before the marriage and afterwards. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. But I blurted out to Renee, I'm having an affair.
While you were getting married?
Yeah. No. 2 days before, 3 days before, a week before.
Right.
She didn't pick up on it, and I didn't pursue it. So both of us let it fall through the crack. Later, she said she thought I was talking about a fantasy affair. Renee needed and wanted to get married. That was very important. Now, after we were doing Grey's Anatomy and we were still working together very well, she was my director and we were touring and we were separated, I said, Renee, I really want to add, help, I'm drowning, help, I'm having an affair in that last section. You know, and this is when she was my director and, you know, really co-advisor. So I took all of her directions. And she said, no, that would throw the audience. And then after I was out on the road without her performing it, Kathy used to say, I think you should put that in. So, and I didn't. I never did. And I think that Renee, as a dramaturg, was right, that it's a really big boomerang to hurl into the monologue at that point. But I really was, when I thought I was drowning and I yell out all the things that I was afraid of, help, I'm growing old, help, I'm going to disappear from this earth forever, it would have been, in my opinion, right to say, help, I'm having an affair.
Right.
I didn't do it.
Spalding Gray will be back with us in the second half of our show. He's performing his new monologue, It's a Slippery Slope, at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater in Manhattan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, when the personal becomes public, we continue our conversation with Spalding Gray about what it's like for him and the people in his life when they become the subject of his monologues. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Counting Crows. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Spalding Gray. He's performing his new autobiographical monologue, It's a Slippery Slope, at Lincoln Center in New York. In the monologue, he confesses that when he got married to his longtime companion and collaborator, Renee Shafransky, he'd been having an affair with another woman named Kathy. His marriage has since broken up, and he's living with Kathy, their baby son, and Kathy's older daughter. Spalding and Kathy are expecting a new baby next month. You know, more than any other monologue, I think this one brings into question boundaries of other people's lives that they may feel you transgress with your monologues. You know, how comfortable is Renee with this monologue? How comfortable right. is Kathy with the monologue? You're even talking about your newborn son, and he's too young to care, but at some point, he'll be older. Are your boundaries changing with that about, or any of your guidelines changing about how far to go with other people's lives?
Well, I'd say that boundaries are changing in this sense that I made a decision today, but I haven't. That's premature. But I don't. I'm careful as where I play it. I wouldn't play this monologue in where I live now in Sag Harbor. You know, I've tried to have a private life there, a relatively private life, where the children aren't on display in the place where they live. It's a little easier in New York City. And one of the things about Renee and I is that we had a sense of community, but the small community that we had always accepted that she gave herself up as a character, a material, after she told me what she approved of and didn't approve of. But so that was an agreement there. Now it's really has changed. And so part of the reason I hit this tree in Tahoe was that I was feeling, Renee's birthday was the 10th of April, and I hit the tree on the 7th. And I was thinking a lot about her. And I think that this accident was an accident, and it wasn't. But as soon as I came down to the condo, I had time to call her and send her flowers for her birthday. So suddenly I was in this open space where I'd normally have been skiing, and she called me to thank me for the flowers and talk about the monologue. And she said, listen, it so happens we're colliding again. I'm going to Los Angeles to look for work as a film script writer, and you're about to play the show there. Your monologue, and I don't want to be going into producers' offices and people saying, oh, poor Renee, the victim. Well, so I'd like to hear what the monologue's about. And this was the first time I have ever spoken my son's name, my son's mom's name, out loud to Renee. But I did it in the context of outlining the monologue, which became a filter system, a go-between. And she listened. And it was a very powerful time on the phone. Instead of sending it to her, I talked it through with her in outline form. And she would stop me at certain points and say, did you say this or that about me? You know, because no, I didn't. You know, I don't portray you or betray you as the victim. And you've got to, I know you don't trust me, but if you don't believe me, there are mutual women friends that have seen this that you can talk to. So when the New York Times Review came out, I felt in a way that was, you know, a stamp of approval in the sense of, you know, they are not saying, poor long-suffering Renee, which the Village Voice might say, but the New York Times didn't. And I think that that I am discreet as I can be in representing a huge mess.
Right. How does it feel for you to go through that mess every night?
Well,
sure not every night, but the nights you perform.
Yeah, well, that's difficult. You see, because it's stirring up a lot of old water, but it ultimately is stirring up in a lyrical way, in a way that is artful or that is both upsetting and redeeming, because it gives it a kind of lyricism, as do the other monologues, my life, lyrical form in feeling like control and closure, whereas at the bottom of it, there's still enormous remorse and guilt and feeling of loss, of not being able to have all of the relationships in place, to still have Renee as a friend, to have my new family, and to go on with all of that. It's an enormous rupture, and it's a sadness. It's a loss. And a part of me thinks, when I think about this, that all my life I've been wrestling with this well of sadness that I could never articulate. I don't know if it had to do with my mom. I suspect it did. She would never... I think she was deeply sad, and she was acting happy all the time. And I was taking on her shadow as a kid. I was interjecting it. And so I was really aware, and I was holding all her sadness for all those years while she was bubbling on and smiling until she killed herself. And so I think a part of me was always looking for the source of the sadness, and now I have produced it in my own life. So now I have a lot of stuff to be really sad about. And that's not bad, because I can feel it and I know what it is.
Kind of like breaking ribs instead of just going through medical books looking for what your symptoms are. You know so much about family betrayal and about... I mean, your mother committed suicide when she was 52, and that has kind of spooked you for the rest of your life. You know about the power that a parent has over a child.
I'm learning that now.
Well, that's the thing. Now you're the father. The father, and you've been in kind of analysis and therapy for so many years, in part because of your relationship to your late mother. So here you are in the parent role. Yourself, are you afraid to take a step, knowing how powerful the impact each of those steps might be on your son?
No, I haven't been. Because the love is so clearly in place with him, and my ability to express it, that I think the foundation is so good that if it goes awry, and I can only see it going awry by him, say, becoming interested in things I'm not, which would be everything. I mean, objects. I mean, I hope he's a fixer. I'm on online virtual reality, whatever. Now my voice is on American cyberspace, and I have questions sent to me, and then I do DAT recordings, and they send them out and put them on whatever they do with that. And so when I was doing a DAT recording, my son was in the room, and one of the questions was, what do you want your son to be when he grows up? And I called him over and asked him, and he said, what do I want to do when I grow up? Well, I'd like to fix something. And I said, all right, that's all I need, is someone to fix something. And if he can fix something, he's in. I said, like the world, fix the world? And he said, well, I fixed a flashlight. So I think this is foundation there that I was totally unaware of with my father. With my mother, it was overdone. You see, it was invasive. And I'm not doing it. I don't think I'm doing it with Forrest.
You know, I'm thinking about your relationship with your mother and your relationship with your son. You think that your mother's love was like too possessive. And you waited 8 months to see your son. You weren't living with his mother when
this is weird, because I had no interest in him, no conscious interest in seeing him, even though Kathy was sending pictures and Renee was looking at them and tossing them in the whatever or complaining about them, and I was just not even studying his face in any way. And Renee had, and I want to say she had asked me not to, told me not to. It was a whole mixture of course, of attitude and anger and rage and confusion, not to see him until we had made some concentrated reconciliation. And then in couple therapy, when we couldn't come to any agreements, the couple therapists proclaimed us in a free fall situation. And then that's when things got really wacky. And it was not until Renee walked out of the loft to go stay with a friend, when she said she couldn't, deal with it anymore, that space came. And when I say space, I've never had a lot of space in my relationship with Renee, because I invited invasiveness. But whenever there was a gap, she would fill it. She is a dynamic, beautiful, smart lady, and she very emotional, and there was not a whole lot of empty space. If I wasn't feeling a moving, she was doing it for me, and I'd grab onto her wake. So when she no longer was filling that mutual space in that loft, as I say in the monologue, when two of us in a room, it was eight people, us, the two children and us, our parents drooling over our shoulder, and the two therapist voices talking, When she left the room and I was in that space, it was only then that I thought, wow, I want to see Forrest. I didn't let it in before that.
Yeforis is the name of your son.
Yeah.
So now you're going to be a father, and you'll be there when the baby's born. I mean,
I hope that I will. I'm supposed to fly out to Los Angeles to be the nanny's therapist. Fran Drescher called me and asked me to play her therapist on The Nanny on television, and I, at the time, it sounded so loopy because I had never seen her show, but they sent me tapes, and I thought, yeah, that would be an interesting juxtaposition. And you know me, I've always wanted, one of my fantasies is I've always wanted to be a therapist. Every nutty guy does. You know, that's how therapists get started. But so I'm worried that, you know, I will be playing Fran, the nanny's therapist, when my son's being born. Son, my daughter, I hope. I said son. Child. We don't know if it's a girl or a boy. And that could cause a nervous breakdown. It's bad enough not to be there for my dad's death, my mom's death, and my son's birth, but for this one to be playing the therapist for the nanny in Hollywood, it would be pretty removed, pretty much turned into an image. So I'm really worried about that the baby's going to come early now because it's kicking up a storm.
I don't suppose you could postpone the shoot.
No, because that would be even get even closer to the birth, and then so we're going to risk it. And I might be playing at Lincoln Center, you know. But I told the producer that I was going to walk off stage. I don't think he believes me.
My guest is Spalding Gray. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Spalding Gray. He's performing his new autobiographical monologue, It's a Slippery Slope, at Lincoln Center. You know what you said before when I was confessing my discomfort at your monologue, and you said, look, I'm not a nice guy.
I'm also a nice guy.
And you're also a nice guy, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's particle wave. You know, it's new physics.
Is this the first time where you feel like you've portrayed the not nice guy part of you in a monologue?
Yeah, I think, again, it's a watershed monologue in the sense that I'm saying I'm also this beast that I think that, you know, I do think that there's a biological clock in men, and I would never have known that until this happened. But the beast in me, I was, you know, spreading my seed around in a really haphazard way. I'm not now. I am in a monogamous relationship one day at a time. You know, I feel like I'm recovering, although I'm not in any 12-step program. But for whatever reasons right now, and I'd say that it has to do with these children and the fact that a lot of extra sexual relationships with men is just the whole beast thing, the lion thing, the whole herd mentality of trying to spread the seed around. And so when that's coming out of me, that makes me a man, and then the men in the audience are responding. I mean, I picture date night Saturday when everyone's, like the guy has his arm around the woman, and in the course of the monologue, it just grows wider and wider, the gap. There's a kind of break there where I used to get all the women writing me letters or laughing or giggling in the audience, and now you hear these cigar-y, whiskery, whiskey-like guffaws from men.
How are you reacting to responsibility, the responsibility of being a father?
So, when I think about it, I get freaky. But Kathy, who I'm living with and is the mother of Forrest and will be of our new child and also mother of a 10-year-old daughter, is what D.W. Winnicott, the English therapist, would call the good enough mother. I would call her a good mother, but Winnicott would call her the good enough mother. And she is, that was her bottom line from high school on, that she wanted to have three children and this, she wanted to be a mother, and she also works. But the thing is that she's old-fashioned in that sense that the mothering issue is big for her, and she does it very well. And if I hadn't probably unconsciously observed that in our relationship with her daughter, you see, when I would see her and I would also see her with her daughter, I picked up on that. So I think that relieves a lot of my anxiety of the responsibility.
But when I think long term, I think, well, you know, it's good I'm 55, because by the time they're teenagers, with any luck, I'll be dead. But when I think really far ahead and getting, you know, it doesn't work. The responsibility of getting Forrest to soccer practice, I don't know, I'm into everything now. I'm into it. I don't have any, like, I don't have a whole lot of stuff left over on my, you know, on my menu that I want to do. And so when I'm with them, what they do, or Marissa and Forrest, Marissa is Forrest's sister, is they, or I allow myself, to see the world and experience the world through their eyes. So a walk with Forrest from our house to downtown Sag Harbor when he's on his little bicycle with little practice wheels is so slow, and the attention is directed at so many things that I would never look at. I would just be completely insensitive to them, that it's a re-experiencing in the best of ways. And it's like a kind of psychedelic drug, but healthier.
You never set out to have children. I mean, it sounds like you're enjoying being a father, but it wasn't
because
something
it
was you planned
an accident.
To do. It was an accident.
Yeah.
So I can only assume you didn't want children up until actually having one. Why didn't you? What was it about parenthood that you looked at and thought, I'll pass, thank you?
The responsibility, that's a good question. I just would say it, you know, like, I don't, just look at a roller coaster, I don't want to ride on the roller coaster, thanks. I am happy with the merry-go-round. I'm happy with what's working right now, what makes sense. I think a child is a variable that is so huge. There's another human being. And also, I suppose, in the relationship that Renee and I had, I basically, in a pop psychology way, felt that it would push the child that was alive in me out. I didn't see that it would also allow that child to become an adult and, you know, just make things richer, you know, but I didn't. And also we weren't easily conceiving. And again, I am probably this old fashioned dog that needs it to be a natural accident. And I think we would have had to struggle much more with it in a scientific controlled way. And then it becomes very aware.
You mean,
very intellectual.
You were actually trying to conceive.
We weren't not.
Right.
We weren't using birth control.
Mm.
You see.
Mm. So you're surprised about what it's like to actually be a father?
I am. I this is one of the big surprises, the fact that I could learn how to ski and the fact that I am, up until now, a good father. Now, I have to say, when Kathy conceived a second time with me, I said, I don't know. First of all, I don't know how this happened. She was switching jobs. We were moving out of New York City. And that was, again, that was an accident. And I thought we were taking, you know, we were very cautious around that. And I said, I can't go through with this. And she said that she would do what I felt was right. And that, she put the ball in my court. And I had a very powerful breakthrough session in therapy where I said, I want to go through with this birth. I want this child. And that was really big for me because I made the decision. And so I felt that I had a hand in this one, or as it were, a psychic hand. But and when I vacillate and think, oh my God, you know, she's 7 months pregnant. I'm used to that now. Why can't it just stay in there? You know, it's easier in there than out. I have to think back to that particular therapy session, and I remember my therapist saying, you know, you've got to remember what you went through now to go with that, you know, in the future.
Mm-hmm. There's a part in your monologue where you're on the ski slope with your family, including Kathy's older daughter, a daughter from another relationship who was about 7 at the time. And she's skiing and you're going, you know, that's great. You're a great skier. And suddenly you realize you're speaking in a non-ironic voice, a voice that you are totally unfamiliar with.
Right.
And I'm thinking, as a father, you probably have to use that non-ironic voice quite a bit.
Yeah, and mainly around yelling at them not to do something, which is why, that's why I didn't want to be a parent, Terry. That was it. I never wanted to be a policeman.
Yeah, right.
I did not want that super ego voice, disciplinarian, not in me, not interested. But it's there, and it's working, and I am firm with the children, and I draw my boundaries for the first time with the children. Yeah, they've taught me boundaries, because they really, you know, they push it, and I yell, and I, you know, I toe the line. That's been there. You know, what was sad for me is that I was never able to use that voice with in my two really long relationships, before with Elizabeth Lecomte, who was with for 12 years, and with Renee Shafransky, where I never was that cheerleader for them. And I think both relationships were somewhat sullied by a competitiveness that didn't allow that voice. And so to hear that come out with Marissa on the slope was a very, very, that was a big breakthrough for me. It was as though I found another part of myself that was missing for all those years.
Well, Spaulding, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on again. I enjoyed it.
Spaulding Gray is performing his new autobiographical monologue, It's a Slippery Slope, at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater, Sundays and Mondays to January 6th. Coming up, a review of Counting Crows' long-awaited new CD. This is Fresh Air. The San Francisco band Counting Crows sold over 4 million copies of their 1993 debut album August and Everything After. Now comes their long-awaited second effort called Recovering the Satellites. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the new collection finds Crows lead singer and songwriter Adam Derwitz in a worse mood than you might expect.
On Recovering the Satellites, Adam Duritz is most intent on establishing his unhappiness. In song after song, he yowls out descriptions and metaphors for his condition. He says he's in a lonely spiral, that he's all messed up, but that's nothing new. He tells us that he can't find his way home in one song, and that he's got a bad case of insomnia in another. Counting Crows had to share the commercial success of their debut album with accusations of doing a brazenly systematic Van Morrison impersonation. On Recovering the Satellites, the singer alternates a persistent Van mania, husky scatting through jazz bow melodies, arbitrary word repetitions, with a shredded vocal cord attack that sounds an awful lot like Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder.
She comes to me at night when I'm sleeping. She comes to me when I'm alone. She comes to me, she holds my hand when I'm crying. She comes to me, she shuts my eyes. She brings me home, but I'm not sleeping anymore.
No other current, pretty enjoyable, smash-hit band is so much a pastiche of its influences as is Counting Crows. The new album is suffused with stylistic fondnesses ranging from The Band and Bob Dylan to Bruce Hornsby and Birds of a Not-So-Different Color, The Black Crows. Recovering the Satellites is certainly a canny creation. The band's sound remains the same, loose, jangly, folk guitar-based, prone to building a song to a rave-up jam, yet not hostile to the occasional string section. As the Crows did last time, they moved into a house in Hollywood to make the album, turning the recording process into a lifestyle event. Astral Weeks meets the real world. This results in a tight yet cozy recording, as well as in self-conscious details that play out as L.A. cliches in a song like A Long December.
A long December, and there's reason to believe maybe this year will be better than the last. I can't remember the last thing that you said as you were leaving. Oh, the days go by so fast, and it's one more day up in the canyon, and it's one more night in Hollywood. If you think that I could be forgiven, I wish you would.
If Recovering the Satellites doesn't contain a tune as friskily friendly as their debut hit, Mr. Jones, it still has a lot of ingratiating music, especially if you don't bother getting caught up in those trite downer lyrics. But what we have here ultimately is a sophomore effort in which more of the same bumps into not just enough. To use Duritz's own terminology, his band's oysters are fresh, but there aren't many pearls.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
I was wasted in the afternoon, waiting on a train. I woke up in pieces and Elizabeth disappeared again. Well, I wish you were inside of me. I hope that you're okay. I hope you're resting quietly. I just wanted to say good night, Elizabeth. Good night, Elizabeth.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.